Hey there, this is Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that is now on the second terrace of Purgatory. We are in Canto 13 of Dante's Purgatorio. We're going to be at lines 22 through 45. We've gotten the Pilgrim Dante and Virgil up onto this livid, bluish-gray stone desert of a terrace, very different from the gorgeous marble terrace of the Proud. We found them standing alone here, Virgil out on the edge as they rotate around the mountain on this terrace, and they're about to find some interesting spiritual presences on this terrace, and they're about to see the first of the penitents ahead of them. This is my English translation of Purgatorio, Canto 13, lines 22 through 45. You can find it on my website, walkingwithdante.com or markscarborough.com. You can print it off, or you can continue the conversation about this passage with me there. I would be glad to do it there, on Facebook, on Instagram, wherever you choose to find me. Otherwise, let's just get to the passage itself. We'd already gone along there for what counts as a mile back home, and at a fairly quick pace since our will was so revved up. When flying right at us, we sensed, but didn't see, spirits who spoke the cordial invitations to love's banquet table. The first voice blew past us, loudly calling out, "Winum non habent." It even repeated the same as it flew on behind us. The first one wasn't even out of hearing in the distance when another one passed by crying out, "I am Orestes." It too didn't pause. "Oh," I said, "Father, what are these voices?" And just as I asked it, behold, a third came saying, "Love those who've done you bad." And my good master said, "This circle horsewhips the guilt of envy. For that very reason, the cords of the whip are braided with love. The bridle will need to resound with its opposite. From what I understand, I believe you'll hear it right before you arrive at the Pass of Pardon. But fix your eyes good and fast on the area here. You'll see a bunch of people seated ahead of us. Each one has his back to the cliff." We're going to break it right there at the first sight of the penitents on this terrace of envy. We could have broken it three lines before when Virgil explains the Pass of Pardon ahead. He now seems to understand the structure of Purgatory, and we seem to understand it with him. We'll talk much more about that. What I'd like to do in this episode of the podcast is I'd like to first focus on these three voices. What are they? I'd like to then turn from that to a discussion of what exactly is the sin here. Virgil names it envy. What's he talking about? We're going to start that discussion in this episode, but it's going to carry on for multiple episodes. Then I'd like to talk about the mechanism of how Purgatory works and how Virgil has intuited the very thematics or schematics or landscape of Purgatory itself. I want to talk a little bit about that bit at the first, the voices themselves, and why they're bodiless, and a possible answer to that question. And finally, as always lately, we'll end up with Virgil. First off, let's talk about these voices, three of them, and I'm going to start at line 28 of the passage. So the voices come at them, they're walking along, they've gone about a mile, and the first one blows past them, calling out a Latin phrase, "Vinum non habent," or "Vinum non habent," if you want to pronounce it in the classical way or the medieval way, that's your business, but basically what it says is they have no wine. There is no wine. This is a reference to the Gospel of John, the second chapter, verses 1 through 12. This is Jesus's first acknowledged miracle at the wedding in Cana. Most Christians accept this as the first miracle Jesus performs, even though this miracle is not necessarily performed first or even at all in other gospels in the New Testament. But since it's the first in John, and since it's so early, it's considered the first, and Jesus kind of cues us, in John at least, that it's to be considered at least there as the first. So what goes on? They're at the wedding of Cana, Jesus and his mother, Mary. They apparently run out of wine. There are jars for ritual purification, the Jewish purification ritual, that are full of water. Jesus asks that some of those jars be brought to him. He turns the water in those jars to wine. The guy then tastes the wine. The host then tastes the wine and can't believe that it's better than the wine he's serving and comes out with that famous comment about, hey, what's going on here? I mean, usually people serve the best wine first and wait until everybody's good and sloshed before they bring out the bad stuff. But we've served less good wine first and we've saved the best for later. A little bit of humor there in the gospel passage. That's this reference here. They don't have any wine and it's Mary. And if you remember, Mary started the progression through the intaglios on the Terrace of Pride. So we get our first hint that the first of the exemplars of the opposite of the sin is Mary. She was the humble servant who accepted the angel's annunciation. And here she seems very concerned about the wedding guests. She's not envying the glorious celebration going on around them. Instead, she's concerned that they're running out of wine and she approaches her son to do something. If you want to know more about this, I suggest you go to Paris. Well, I always suggest you go to Paris. I suggest you go to Paris and skip all those people looking at the Mona Lisa. Oh, really, honestly. And look at the other side of that room. The other side is the giant Veronese canvas of the marriage Cana. It's an absolutely spectacular piece of work. Good grief. That Veronese painting about knocked me out when I was 17. The first time I went to Paris by myself at 17. It was different days in the 1970s. Anyway, so there's this lavish feast going on. And Mary is not concerned about envying all the extravagance. Instead, she thinks, oh my gosh, they're running out of wine. They don't have any wine. And she comes to her son. Two things that are a little interesting here. One, that it is Jesus' first miracle. That's interesting because we're going to circle around that a little bit when it comes to envy. But just hold that in your head for a little bit. Second, it's a wedding banquet. And if you remember, in this very passage that I've read to you, the spirits that fly by speak the cordial invitations to love's banquet table. So already when they are assessed, when the poet explains who these voices are, there's already kind of a setup for the marriage of Cana. We've had this from Dante repeatedly, that he kind of sets something up before he drops it. But there's a second little bit here that's interesting. That is that Jesus seems a little irritated with Mary in the sequence in the gospel. He basically tells her that his time has not yet come. Like, don't bug me to do a miracle. It's not yet time for me to be revealed as who I am. And he even gives a rather infamous line from the Gospels, woman, what has that to do with me? I mean, what has their problem got to do with who I am? The woman part sounds a little harsh in English. It's actually not quite so harsh in the text and would actually be closer to a term of endearment, but he doesn't call her mother. So he separates himself a little from her. Just hold that too in your head, that he doesn't say, mother, what has that to do with me? He says, woman, and that just puts a little bit of distance between him and her. That's sitting here for an important reason, I think, way back behind the text, but we'll come to it in a bit. Okay, let's go to the second voice. So the second voice comes through, it whips around just like the first one did, and we get the idea, by the way, that these voices keep repeating around and around the terrace, because it says at line 30, it even repeated the same line, they don't have any wine, as it flew on behind us. So we get the idea these voices are whipping around the mountain and, repeating themselves over and over again. So then the second one comes and it says, I am Orestes. This is a classical example, just as we had a classical example with the proud. In this case, Dante's getting this from Cicero's De Finibus. And this is a story of Orestes, the son of Agamemnon. He's captured, it's a long story of why, but let's just truncate it for the sake of the podcast and say he's captured by the tyrant Taurus, and the tyrant Taurus captures both Orestes and his best friend Pylades. Pylades and Orestes are both then now imprisoned under Taurus's edict, and Taurus decides he wants to put Orestes to death. Pylades speaks up and says, no, I'm Orestes. And then they both start calling out, I'm Orestes. No, I'm Orestes. No, I'm Orestes. And this is an example of somebody being so concerned about their friend's life that they're willing to stand in his place in order to be killed so that he isn't killed. We're basically told that the cords of the whip that whips envy are made out of love. And this is certainly a form of love. But there's a problem here. In Dante's day and after Dante, all the way up through Handel, all the way up through the neoclassical period, but even before Dante, long even back in the classical age, the friendship between Orestes and Pylades is often cited as an example of homoerotic love, or a love between men that is beyond mere friendship. Is that sitting back behind this passage? Maybe. And the only reason I can say maybe is because Dante's attitude toward homosexuality will change over the course of Purgatorio, as we'll see when we near the top and get to the lustful. That change from their burning up in hell with Brunetto Latini to Purgatorio. Maybe. It may be sitting there. The bigger question right now that you might want to think about is, who says I am Orestes? It's a question, right? Because is Orestes the one saying it, or is it Pylades who says I am Orestes? It's not exactly clear here who says it. And you should just know that Dante's just love to argue about this, whose voice is actually being heard here, because they both are yelling it out to say, kill me, kill me, kill me. We get this idea of sacrificial substitution. This is tying us back to Jesus right before this in the marriage of Cana, the wedding at Cana. I mean, we're getting this idea that love is this sacrificial antidote to envy. And then finally, the third voice comes, and this really nails it. Dante seems afraid and says, Father, what are these voices? And just as he asks, a third one comes blowing past them and says, love those who've done bad to you. This is a paraphrase from the Sermon on the Mount in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5, verses 43 through 45. And this is where Jesus says, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who persecute you. He pushes everyone beyond their comfort zone. He says, basically, you know, you've heard love your friends and hate your enemies, but I got news for you. If you want to follow me, you got to go beyond that and love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who persecute you. I think that this last voice really ties it together. Now we know it's about love. We saw love's banquet table early on at line 27. Now we hear this quote from Jesus from the Sermon on the Mount. We now know that love is tied up here with envy, and that's important to know because, of course, as you know, in Christian theology, love is the greatest virtue. And the greatest virtue is being here invoked with envy, not pride. There are actually reasons for that. We'll get to it in a minute. But love seems to be the very heart of the matter. Okay, those are the three voices that go flying past them, rotating around the mountain. Now I have a good question for you, and one that I can't answer. So these voices seem to be coming at them, right? They're walking. We know they're walking to the right around the mountain. These voices seem to be moving from the left toward them. Is that significant? It's a big question, and one that I don't have a ready answer to. It seems as if we've got a centralized motion here. Remember, if we turn hell upside down, everything's been going the same way all along, and Virgil seems to intuit which way they should turn here, to the right, and yet here comes voices from the left. It's a little strange. Does Dante nod and forget the symbolism? Oh, I don't think so. I don't think that's possible, but maybe. I mean, these are grand examples of love. Mary's concern for the people throwing the wedding, Pylades or Orestes' concern for each other as friends, particularly Pylades' concern for Orestes, and then Jesus' great pronouncement about love your enemies and do good to those who have done bad to you. These don't seem to come from the left in Dante's iconography. They seem to come from the right. So why are they going the wrong, as it were, wrong direction around the mountain? It's a big question, and I tell you that most dentistas do exactly what I'm about to do, which is skip over it, because it's hard to answer. Do they come from the left because they're counter to the way that most people walk? I think that's probably the best answer. But if you accept that answer, that these are counter the way humans behave, and that envy is a root human problem, as we'll discover, then in fact, Dante has kind of negated the right-left problem that he's worked out all along in comedy. Big question. So let's just leave it on the floor and talk a little bit about envy. At line 37, Virgil says, my good master says, but Virgil says, this circle horsewhips the guilt of envy. And I just want to stop on that word, envy. This is the sin now. Virgil has announced it. How does Virgil know this? Has he intuited it from these voices? Could you intuit that envy is the problem here? When Mary says they don't have any wine and somebody calls out, I am Orestes, and Jesus says, love those who've done you bad. Could you intuit that the sin here is envy? Not sure. But Virgil seems to know it, and we're going to just accept that Virgil understands that the sin here is envy. He certainly seems to understand that the remedy is love. How does he then get to envy from that? I'm not sure of the deductive reasoning that would go on, but I can tell you this. Way back in Inferno, Canto 1, line 111, way back at the beginning of comedy, Dante posits that envy is the root sin that destroys the world, not pride, but envy. And in fact, you can even find this in the Bible. In the Wisdom of Solomon, what Catholics accept as a book of the Bible, Protestants think it's apocryphal, but nonetheless, what Dante would accept as part of the Bible, Wisdom, in chapter 2, line 24, the statement is made that Satan's envy allowed death to enter the world. So there, the prime sin, the fundamental sin, the base sin, is envy, not pride, as it's often thought. You should just know that blue-gray, the color that is livid, blue-gray, was the traditional color of envy in Dante's day, not green as we now think in English. He was green with envy, but instead this livid blue-gray color, it is the color of envy. And a medieval reader might have been cued by that blue-gray hue of the landscape. We'll have a lot more to say about envy ahead, and I don't want to quite define it here, except I want to say that envy is often considered and is a big contender for the fundamental sin in the Middle Ages. Now, I know you and I don't think much about envy because we've retranslated it into jealousy. But Dante doesn't mean jealousy. He doesn't mean FOMO. And he doesn't mean you wish that you had what other people had. That is not what he means by envy. We'll clarify this as we go forward. But in the Middle Ages, there was a lot of effort expended on explaining envy itself because it's often seen as a rival for the root sin. Dante seems to signal this at Inferno 1. The Wisdom of Solomon seems to signal this in the Bible. Most clerics and theologians still hold to pride, certainly as the biggest sin, and Dante surely would hold to that since it's the first terrace of purgatory. But envy's a close second, and sometimes even really close primary to it. There's a lot of, we'll get to this, a lot of medieval thought that part of Satan's attempt to tempt Adam and Eve is because he's envious of them in the garden. It's not that necessarily he's proud and he wants to somehow defeat God. It's that he hates it that God has made a place so nice for these newly created beings. We'll talk much more about that in the episodes ahead. So Virgil offers us the explanation for Purgatorio and how it's going to work on the terraces. Now we know that there are more than one terrace. They're going to be seven, but okay. Now we know that there are more than just one. And in fact, Virgil now says at line 37, this circle horsewhips the guilt of envy. For that very reason, the cords of the whip are braided with love. So there's a whip. And then Virgil says at line 40, the bridle will need to resound with its opposite. From what I understand, I believe that you'll hear it right before you arrive at the Pass of Pardon. That would be the stairway up. So Virgil has kind of intuited the landscape of purgatory here. There is a circle around the mountain. We get to see these exemplars here. We get to see Mary again. We get to see Orestes or Pylades. We get to hear a quote from Jesus. These exemplars toward love, the greatest virtue. If it's the greatest virtue, doesn't that mean this is the greatest sin? See, we're back in that squishy ground of which comes first, the chicken or the egg? No, which comes first, pride or envy? We're back in that little squishy ground. Virgil has now intuited the mechanism that goes on. This reminds me of the moment in Inferno when Bertrand de Bourne gives out the big rationale that everything is contrapasso. Remember this? Everything is experienced against what you did, that you're punished in the same way that you sin, or your sin is in such a way that it predicts your punishment and they're linked in some fundamental way. Well, in the same way, now we're given the mechanism, except, and here's the difference. In Inferno, we're way down there in the Malabolgia with the schismatics before we get the rationale for how it works, the schematic for how Inferno works. Here it comes pretty early, Purgatorio 13. We're only on the second terrace of Purgatory proper. This is what gives some people problems. It starts to feel like fill in the blank. If you give me the rationale up front, as Dante now does in Virgil's mouth, then I'm going to expect it on every terrace, and it's going to have a fill-in-the-blank quality about it. I will tell you that I think that's a little bit of a problem for Dante in terms of the reader's response. I think it would probably have been better had he delayed a bit, just as he did with Bertrand de Bourne, finally explaining it as we're on up the mountain, because now, forevermore, when we hit the third and the fourth and the fifth and the sixth and the seventh terrace, I'm going to say to you, oh, here's the whip, and oh, here's the bridle. Here's what goads you on, and here's what holds you back, just as we did on Pride. The intaglios goad you on to the good, and then those grave carvings in the roadbed, those are the exemplars that hold you back, that say, watch out, here are the proud. Let's jump off the poetics for a second and talk about something that's even odder here. I'm going to start back at the front of the passage. We'd already gone along there for what counts for about a mile back home. And you should just know the word here is a word, classical word used to indicate mile markers. And I don't mean a mile as we now think in the United States. Oh, don't get me started on kilometers and why we're not using them. Anyway, a mile, you know, 5,280 feet. We're talking about actually 1,000 paces as a mile, a typical classical reference to a mile. So we've gone about 1,000 paces would be a nice way to translate this. And they're moving quickly because Virgil has said, hey, we got to hurry. We can't wait around here for somebody to tell us where to go. We just got to get moving around this circle to find the next staircase up. And then flying right at us, they sensed but didn't see. And this is really important here. Sensed but didn't see. See. Now, listen, we've already talked about this. Virgil looks at the sun, is blinded, and gives a pagan prayer. The penitents ahead of us through our read-through, you know, are blinded, have their eyes sewn shut. So that these spirits are not seen is all part of this, what do I want to say, ocular metaphor, this ocular imagery that is going to pervade this entire terrace. So here come these spirits. They sense them, but they don't see them. They blow past. I take it that you can kind of feel the wind since the word is sensed, not just heard. They do hear them, but sensed too. And then they speak the cordial invitations to love's banquet table. What's interesting here is that while they are offering the love antidote to the sin, envy. And of course, this sets us up for the first marriage at Cana, love's banquet table, as I already said. What's also interesting here is that there is just a node of alienation in this. I mean, when we got to that first Terrace of the Proud, we saw those gorgeous intaglios carved into the side. We saw, in fact, David dancing in front of the Ark. We saw Mary at the Annunciation. We saw Trajan and the Widow. Then we saw all those carvings in the roadbed. Everything seemed kind of glorious and beautifully done. Here on this terrace, everything feels cold and, to use the word in the terrace, livid, bluish gray. These voices continue that thematic of alienation. And I'm going to bring you back to Jesus and Mary at the wedding of Cana when he turns to her and he doesn't say, mother, what is that to do with me? He says, woman, what is that to do with me? And even though it, again, sounds harsher in English than it would sound in the Greek, or better, the Aramaic, if it were originally spoken, still, nonetheless, the relationship term between the two of them is dropped. And there's just a soupçon, just a hint of alienation, of distance right there. And this alienation is fundamental to the way this terrace works. And that these are disembodied voices brings us into this kind of rubric that there's a way of a, what do I want to say? There's a way of a disconnect, a fundamental disconnect that's going to go on inside of what happens in this terrace. This is going to be one of the few times, there are several in comedy, but one of the few times where shades, or those dead, talk about the pilgrim in the third person. There's a weird way in which alienation permeates the circle of envy, and we want to talk more about that in the episodes ahead, but just start thinking about the way that envy increases a sense of alienation, of distance. Now, I'm not saying that Jesus is envious of Mary. What I'm saying is that all of these things lead us to posit a little space, that in fact, we're people should be close to each other. There's just a little space. And here too, Dante sidles very close to Virgil in this, and he calls him father, which is going to lead us to the final point of this episode. But still, nonetheless, alienation is crucial, and the way to overcome that alienation is crucial. Which brings us to Virgil. As you know, of course it would. At line 34, Dante calls him father. Father, what are these voices? And then we get this odd bit from Virgil at line 41. The bridal will need to resound with its opposite. Virgil says, from what I understand, you'll see the other part, the rain, the part that pulls you back. That is, the people who were very envious and are exemplars of the sin of envy rather than exemplars of the way out of envy, as we have here. And we're going to see that bridal or rain ahead of us. But it's that little bit he says, the bridal will need to resound with its opposite. From what I understand, I believe that you'll hear it right before you arrive at the pass of pardon. From what I understand? What do you understand? How do you know this, Virgil? How did you intuit this so fast? How did you understand the architecture of what's happening here? And maybe the answer here lies back in the passage right in behind us, the first bit of Canto 13, when Dante addresses Virgil as my poet. Is there a way that Virgil as a poet can see the structure and the schematics more quickly, that he can intuit them more quickly? I think all of this is bound up in the increasingly complex nature of Virgil in comedy. And over the course of Purgatorio, Virgil's character gets more and more complicated. Just think about what we've just had, even in this canto. We've had Virgil referred to as my poet, my poet. We've had him referred to as father. He seems to know things from what I understand. I believe you'll hear it right before you arrive at the pass of pardon. And yet here too, right in these opening lines, he's offered a pagan prayer to the sun. This is a very complicated relationship with Virgil, and I'm going to give you my read on this. Dante needs to be close to Virgil, and he wants to be close to Virgil, but he also needs to show Virgil as a pagan for two different reasons. One, to show that he is not envious of Virgil. If you think about it, right here would be the prime moment in which the poet's envy at Virgil could be expressed as it was expressed back in The Thieves when Dante said, hey, I'm better than Lucid and I'm better than Ovid at Metamorphoses. We might expect a similar moment of envy here at the great master poet Virgil, but by making Virgil offer a pagan prayer, and by making Virgil both my poet and my father, and by making Virgil know a lot but still be damned, we put that little space of alienation in there, and therefore we keep envy out of the relationship of Dante and Virgil. And I think that there is also a way in which Dante is expressing his distance from Virgil. And Dante needs Virgil to be a guide, but not be his sole world. How can I explain this? I know I've tried to many times on this podcast. So let me try it one more time. Okay, let's say... let me think for a sec. Okay, let me say that you're going to write as a dream vision, you're going to write the history of the Jews. And you're going to write this all the way back from Egypt and the Passover through Sinai. You're going to write the entire scope of Jewish history. And somehow you're going to be guided in some kind of celestial timeline through Jewish history, all the way through the Holocaust, the founding of the state, modern state of Israel. I mean, you're just going to do this whole thing. So you think, history of the Jews. You know, I need a really good historian who would lead me through this. And let's say, this is absurd, but hey, it's spur of the moment thought. Let's say you say, okay, in my vision, I'm going to make Edward Gibbon. I'm going to make him be my big hero that's going to lead me across Jewish history. So Gibbon is going to be the guide, and I'm going to need that because I need a big historian to give gravitas to my history of the Jewish people. But you know, as well as I know, that sooner or later, Gibbon's Christianity is going to start to bug you, and it's going to start to enter into problems. And he's not going to really understand Judaism. He's not going to understand Pesach. He's not going to understand why Jewish festivals happen. He's going to seem a little befuddled by it. Maybe he's going to even pray to Jesus in the middle of your history of the Jewish people. It's all going to get a little funky. But he's still going to give you weight as this big historian helping you see the complete history. That's what's happening here. Dante has got this pagan poet that gives him gravitas, that gives him weight, that adds a directional functionality to his poem, but he also needs a little space from him. And so he needs him to appear pagan at the same time that he needs him to be a poetic guide. So it's not that Gibbon's Christianity is that which is helping you see the history of the Jewish people. It's Gibbon's stance as a historian that's helping you tell the story of the Jews. In the same way here, it's not Virgil's paganism that is leading Dante on. It's Virgil's poetry. And it's the ability to have a poetic father. I don't share beliefs with him, but I do share poetics with him. And his poetry allows him, as a master poet, to even infer the structure of what's ahead inside this. Even though I need to remind you, via that prayer to the sun, that he is indeed not one of these penitents. That's a lot to say about this passage. So let's read it one more time. Purgatorio, Canto 13, lines 22 through 45. We'd already gone along there for what counts as a mile back home, and at a fairly quick pace since our will was so revved up, when flying right at us we sensed, but didn't see, spirits who spoke the cordial invitations to the love's banquet table. The first blew past us, loudly calling out, Winum non habent. It even repeated the same when it flew on behind us. The first one wasn't even out of hearing in the distance when another passed by, crying out, I am Orestes. It, too, didn't pause. Oh, I said, Father, what are these voices? And just as I asked it, behold, a third came, saying, Love those who've done you bad. And my master said, This circle horsewhips the guilt of envy. For that very reason, the cords of the whip are braided with love. The bridle will need to resound with its opposite. From what I understand, I believe you'll hear it right before you arrive at the pass of pardon. But fix your eyes good and fast on the air here. You'll see a bunch of seated people ahead of us. Each one has his back to the cliff. And we'll get to those penitents in the next episode. In fact, we're moving out of Dante and Virgil and into one of the most remarkable figures in all of comedy. She lies right ahead of us with her back against that wall. She rivals almost anyone we've met so far in her humor, her honesty, her truth-telling, and perhaps in her minorly still envious ways here in purgatory. To get there, you have to subscribe to this podcast. If you wouldn't mind, it'd be great if you could rate it. Thanks to for the financial support for this podcast. I really thank all of you who have clicked on the links and made that happen. It's great to not have to worry about how to pay for this. So thank you for that. And otherwise, I will see you just ahead as we see these first livid blue-gray souls on the second terrace of purgatory. I'm Mark Scarborough. I'll see you then.